from PRI, Public Radio International.
He was looking at the bench where all the towels had gathered in stacks. 14 towels. There was no way those towels were going home with the right families. Folded there in multicolored order, they seemed part of some problem Edison had solved this week, or dreamed of, or was working on now.
You're listening to James Norton reading from Ron Carlson's story, Towel Season, part of today's edition of Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Ron Carlson, the author of the first story on this program, teaches writing at the University of California, Irvine. His newest book is the novel Five Skies. His story, The H Street Sledding Record, brought in a lot of mail from listeners responding to its evocation of the possibilities for true happiness in American suburban family life and marriage. Appropriately enough, this story was read in a suburban setting at the Westport Country Playhouse in Westport, Connecticut, in a program co-presented by the Playhouse and the Westport Arts Center. The reader is one of our regular leading men, the actor, singer, and director, James Norton. Ron Carlson's Towel Season.
Suddenly it was June, and there were strange towels in the house. There were stacks on the table in the entry, two or three towels that Edison knew were not their towels. In the hall, he'd step over large striped piles of strange wet towels waiting to be washed. The kids, Rebecca and Tony, pedaled home in bathing suits. Alien towels hung on their necks. Twice Edison tripped as he sidled through the laundry room carrying his files, his feet tangled in a great heap of these damp things. The commotion brought Leslie from the kitchen, and she looked down at him, the absent-minded professor, his papers around his head. "You're kind of too young for this kind of thing," she said. He didn't look uncomfortable. She knew if she left him there and went back to her potato salad, there was a good chance he'd simply go to sleep. He was up past one almost every night working on his largest mathematical project. This was his final experimental journey for the firm. If it worked, he was going to be able to go on and on toward the edge. If not, he would join all the other middle-level engineers. "Whose towels are these?" The answer was, depending on the day, the Hanovers, the Plums, the Reeds. Close radius towels. The Hanovers and their pool just down the street, the Plums and their pool around the corner, and the Reeds and their pool not three blocks across from the elementary school. All the children, nine total, of these people attended. "These, dear, are the Plums, and we'll be returning them this evening when we go over there for a cookout. So get your work done." She picked up his files and laid them on his chest. "Okay. Swimming, drinks on their patio, remember? Don't worry, when the time comes, I'll drive us all over." Edison crawled to his feet. "All right." Leslie watched him go into his study, and then she stuffed the towels in the washer. He was working on the most advanced and important calculations of his life. The firm only kept one or two theoretical mathematicians, and this project would determine if Edison would make the cut. The summer developed into these dinners and all the shifting towels. That night they loaded the car and drove 500 yards to the Plums and drifted with the Hanovers and the Reeds toward the gate, carrying their coolers and casseroles and Tupperware containers and the bundle of towels. They seemed like zombies in a fog to Edison, because he was in a fog most of the time himself. So many hours working at his computer screen and inside the greetings continued, even though they'd all seen one another at the Reeds 3 nights ago. Edison and Alan Reed opened bottles of Corona and sat out on the picnic table in the steady heat of the season. These outings always disoriented Edison, who saw them as some kind of puzzle. Part of him was still at his green screen, mulling equations, while he watched the children spill into the green pool and the women set out the food. "How's the project going, Ed?" Alan asked him. Alan Reed, large and tan, was an applications engineer for the firm. Ed looked at the man's skin, so dark from the sun he seemed part of the strangeness. What kind of engineer has such a tan? Alan was about 5 years older than Edison and had an affectionate condescension for theoretical math. "I'm working every day," Edison said. He was looking at the bench where all the towels had gathered in stacks. 14 towels. There was no way those towels were going home with the right families. Folded there in multicolored order, they seemed part of some problem Edison had solved this week, or dreamed of, or was working on now. "Yes, well, you let me know when they find a market for chaos and its theory, and I'll come over with my slide rule and give you a hand." Alan was going to pat Edison on the shoulder, which he did with people he was kidding, but he saw that Edison was about 2 seconds from getting the joke. They were all used to these moments, these odd moments with Edison. The thing that was said about Edison, at least once every party, after he'd been asked a question and then waited 5 or 10 seconds to answer, or after one of his rare remarks, was, "I'm glad I'm not a genius." Which was meant as a kind of compliment, and many times simply as a space filler after some awkwardness. And even early in the summer, on the way home from a cookout, Toby, who was 6 years old, started crying, and when questioned about his grief, stuttered out in a whisper, "Daddy's a genius." He cried as Leslie carried him to the house in one of the large pale blue towels that Edison knew was not their towel. And he cried himself to sleep. Undressing for bed, Leslie said, "Ed, can you lighten up a little? Fit in? These are my friends." "Sure," he said as he got in bed beside her. "I think I can do that." A long moment later, he turned to Leslie and said, "But I'm not a genius. I'm just in a tough section of this deal right now. Can you tell Toby I'm just busy? I need to finish this project." "I know you do," she whispered. "What should I tell him it's like?" When they were dating, he'd begun to try to explain his work to her in metaphors, and she'd continued the game through his career, asking him for comparisons that then she'd inhabit and embellish. Right after they were married and Edison was in graduate school, he'd work late into the night in their apartment and crawl into bed with the calculations still percolating in his head. "What's it like?" Leslie would ask. "Where are you now?" She could tell he was remote, lit. They talked in territories. "I've crossed all the open ground, and the wind has stopped now. My hope is to find a way through this next place." "Mountains?" "Right, okay, mountains. Blank, very few markings." He spoke carefully and with a quiet zeal. "They're steep, hard to see." "Is it cold?" "No. But it is strange. It's quiet." Then he'd turn to her in bed, his eyes bright and alive. "I'm way past the path. I don't think anyone has climbed this route before. There are no trails, handholds." Leslie would smile and kiss him in that close proximity. "Keep going," she'd say. "Halfway up that mountain, there's a woman with a cappuccino cart and a chicken salad sandwich." me. Then a smile would break across his face, too, and he would see her and kiss her back and say it, right, you. Now in bed, Edison said, tell him it's like, he paused and ran the options, playing hide and seek. At night in the forest? Yes, he was whispering. It's a forest, and parts of this thing are all over the place. It's going to take a while. The Hanover's party was like all the parties, a ritual that Edison knew well. The kids swam while the adults drank. Then the kids ate and went off into the various corners of the house, primarily for television. And then the adults ate their grilled steaks or salmon or shish kebabs and drank a new wine while it got dark and they flirted. It was easy and harmless. And whoever was up was sent to the kitchen or the cooler for more potato salad or beer and returned and gave whatever man or woman whatever he or she had asked for and said, as a husband or wife might, there you are, honey. Can I get you anything else, dear? And maybe there'd be some nudging, a woman punctuating the sentence with her hip at a man's shoulder, or a man taking a woman's shoulders in both hands, possessively. At some point, there'd be Janny Hanover and Scott Plum coming out of the house holding hands, and Janny announcing, Scott and I have decided to elope. And he'd add, I've got to have a woman who uses mayonnaise on everything. In their swimsuits in the dark, arms around each waist, now parting and rejoining the group, they did look as if it were a possibility. The eight adults were interchangeable like that, as swimsuit silhouettes, Edison thought, except me. I'm too skinny and too tall. I'd look like a woman's father walking out of the patio doors like that. I'd scare everybody. Around the pool, the towels glowed in random splashes where they'd been thrown. Edison listened to the men and women talk, and when they laughed, he tried to laugh, too. Days, while Leslie took Toby and Becky to the shoe store, the orthodontist, tennis lessons, Edison worked on his project. He was deep in the fields, each problem more like a long, long hike. He had to go way into each to see the next corner and then there to see forward. He had to keep his mind against it the entire time. One slip and he'd have to backtrack. Edison described his work to Leslie now the same way he began to think of it, as following little people through the forest. Some would weave through the trees while others would hide behind trees and change clothes, emerging at a different speed. He had to keep track of all of them, shepherd them through the trees and over a hill that was not quite yet in sight, and line them up for a silver bus. The silver bus was Leslie's contribution. He'd work on butcher paper with pencils, and then after 2 or 3 o'clock, he would enter his equations into the computer and walk out into his house, his face vague, dizzy, not quite there yet. Summer began in earnest, and women began stopping by with towels. Edison would hear Janny Hanover or Paula Plum call from the front hall, the strange female voices coming to him at first from the field of numbers, progressing across wide paper. Don't get up, it's just me. See you tonight at the Reeds. And then the door would shut again, and Edison would fight with his rising mind to stay close to the shifting numerals as they squirmed and wandered. He felt at such moments as if he were trying to gather a parachute in a tricky and persistent wind. Some days, there'd be a tan face suddenly at his study door, Paula Plum or Melissa Reed saying, so this is where the genius does it, and placing 2 or 3 folded towels on the chair. The incursion was always more than Edison could process. He looked up at the woman, a hot pink tank top, sunglasses in her hair, and felt as if he'd been struck. The calculation bled, toppled. Edison felt involved in some accident. His hands collapsed, his heartbeat in his face. Then she was gone, whoever she had been, singing something about tonight or tomorrow night at the Plums or the Reeds, and Edison found himself dislocated, wrecked. His children knew not to barge in that way because it meant his day's work vanished, and he'd spend hours looking out the front window or walking the neighborhood in the summer heat. The chasm between his pencil figurings and the figures of the real world was that, a chasm, and there was no bridge. At the Reeds and the Plums, while the kids splashed in the pool and Scott flirted with Melissa and Alan with Paula, silhouettes passing in and out of the house as summer darkness finally fell, while everyone was fed grilled meat of all kinds and Paula Plum's tart potato salad, word got out that Edison was brusque, at least not hospitable. And Janie Hanover lifted her wine to him, saying, "Why, darling, you looked absolutely like I was going to steal your trigonometry." Edison smiled at her, feeling Leslie's gaze. He promised he'd try to do better. Holding his smile was pure effort. "And you looked at me like you didn't even know who I was," Paula added. Edison didn't know what to say. Held the smile, tried to chuckle, might have, and then it became painfully clear that he should say something. He couldn't say what he thought. "I don't know who you are." The faces glowed in a circle around him, the healthy skin, all those white teeth. "Well, my heavens." And there was a pause which they all knew they would fall into, and people knew that they would have to do something, cough, get up for more beer, make a joke. He'd done this to this group a dozen times already this summer. What an oddball. Then he spoke. "Do you ladies go through the neighborhood surprising every geek who's double-checking his lottery numbers?" And the pause sparked. And Dan Hanover laughed, roared. And the laughter carried all of them across, and it was filled with gratitude. And something else that Edison saw in Leslie's eyes, something about him. He'd scored a point. There was a new conviviality about him. He'd scored a point. So throughout the night, more laughter. The men brought Edison another beer. Leslie suddenly was at ease. Children drifted in and out of the pool, docking between their parents' legs for a moment, then floated away, dropping towels here and there. Edison, the new center of the group, felt strange. Warm and doomed. The following days were different from any he had ever known. People treated him how? Cordially? Warmly? More than that. This new fellowship confused him. He'd obviously broken the code and was inside now. His research crashed and vanished. At the butcher paper with his pencils, he was like a man in a silent woods at night, reaching awkwardly for things he could not see. "I'm going in circles. Is any of it familiar? Is there a moon?" Leslie asked. "Shall I honk the horn of the silver bus? Start a bonfire? There's no light, no wind. I'm stalled. Go uphill. You'll see the horizon." But he didn't. The work he'd done, all the linkages, had been delicate. And after 2 days, the numbers paled and dried, and the adhesive dissipated. And while he stared at the sheet, the ragged edges of the last figures, it all ran away. He was going to have to turn around, follow the abstruse calculations back until he could gather it all again. Edison left the room. He walked the long blocks of his neighborhood in the heat, lost and stewing. Days, he began to ferry the kids around and was surprised to start learning the names of their friends. The young Plums, the Hanover girl, the Reed twins. He was surprised by everything, the pieces of a day, the way they fit and then fled. He'd wait in the van at the right hour, and the children would wander out of the movie theater and climb in. It was a wonder. He started cooking, which he'd always enjoyed, but now he started cooking all the time. Permutations on grilled cheese sandwiches. Variations on spaghetti. He delivered towels, returning stacks of cartoon characters to the Hanovers. Denver Bronco logo towels to the Plums, who had moved here from Colorado, and huge striped things to the Reeds, always trading for his family's mongrel assemblage. He became familiar with the women, dropping in on them at all daytime hours, calling in the front doors, "Man in the house!" And hearing after a beat, Janny or Melissa or Paula call, "Thank heaven for that! Come on in!" If the kids were in the car, he'd drop the towels and greetings and hurry out. If not, sometimes it was coffee. Melissa Reed put a dollop of Jägermeister in hers. Janny Hanover drank directly out of a liter Evian bottle. Offering him any of her husband's ales, Dan was a member of the Ale of the Month. Paula made him help her make lemonade from scratch. All of the women were grateful for the company. These visits and the weekend parties made Edison, in his new life, feel as if he were part of a new, larger family, with women and children everywhere. He was with people more than he'd ever been in his life. In bed, he didn't want to talk. His hands ran over Leslie in his approach. She held him firmly, adjusted, asked, "What is it like now, the project?" Edison put his head against her neck, stopped still for a beat, and then began again, working along her throat. "Ed, should I worry about you? Where are you with the research?" He lifted away from her in the dark, and then his hand descended, and she caught it. She turned toward him now, and he pulled to free his hand, but she held it. It was an odd moment for them. "Edison," she said, "what is going on?" They were lying still, not moving. "Are you okay? Have you stumbled on a log and hit your head on a sharp outcropping? Has a mighty bear chased you up a nasty tree? Did he bite you? Should I call that helicopter they use in the mountains?" He could hear the smile in her voice. "What do you need me to do? Where are the little people?" It was clear he was not going to answer. "They're waiting for you. Go get them. And I'm waiting too, remember, by the silver bus? You'll make it, Ed." But when she let go of his hand and kissed him, he held still 1 second and then simply just turned away. The project needed to be done this season. It couldn't smolder for another year. They'd take him off it and have him counting beans in the group cubicles. They put you out on the frontier like this once, and when you came back beaten, you joined one of the teams. Your career in close orbit, the adventure gone. Meanwhile, he fled the house. He'd stand close to Paula at the counter while they squeezed the lemons, their arms touching. He began having a drop of Jaeger with Melissa, and when Janny Hanover would see him to the door, they'd hug for 5 seconds, which is 1 second over the line. He could feel her water bottle against his back. Some afternoons, Leslie would stand in the doorway of his little study and see the spill of pencils where they'd been for days. She kept the hallway clear of laundry, but he never went to that corner of the house anymore. They circled each other through the days. In bed, he was silent. She tried to open him. "Okay, mister, should I try to drive the bus closer? Honk the horn? You want me to bring in some of those all-terrain vehicles? Some kind of signal? We're running low on crackers." After a moment, he said, "I'm not sure. Can you see any landmarks, stars?" "Not really," he answered. "I can't." His voice was flat, exhausted, as he tried to imagine it all. It's steep. It's too dark. I'm having some trouble with my footing. I know you are. Everybody does, Leslie said, opening her eyes and looking at his serious face. Keep your own path. Dig your feet in. Try. Paula wanted to know if he really worked for the CIA. Janny wanted to know if his IQ was really 200. Melissa asked him if she should get implants. She was drinking her green coffee at the kitchen table, and she simply lifted her shirt. The fresh folded towels stood on the corner of the table. The afternoons he was home between errands were the worst. Now his calculations seemed a cruel puzzle, someone else's work, dead, forgotten, useless. Edison was a light at the parties, sharing recipes and inside information on the children. There was always someone at his right hand talking, a man or a woman. He was open now, yet still exotic. His difference was clear. He was the only man still not settled, the only man still becoming, unknown. And it gave him an allure that Leslie felt. And she watched him the way you watch the beast in a fairy tale to see if it is really something very good in other clothing. Certainly the parties were less of a strain for her now, not having to worry about Edison's oddness, his potential for gaffes, but his new state strained everything else. By August, the women's familiarity with Edison was apparent. At the cookouts, they spoke in a kind of shorthand, and others had to ask them to back up, explain, if they were to understand at all. Janny Hanover let her hand drift to Edison's shoulder as they talked. Paula Plum began using certain words she'd learned from him. Vector, valence, viable. Melissa Reed returned from a week-long trip, supposedly to see her parents in Boulder, with four new swimsuits and a remarkable bust line. Then suddenly it was Labor Day, an afternoon no different from the 100 before it. But as Edison swept the pool patio and washed the deck chairs and cleaned the grill, he knew summer was, in some way, over. But he wanted the exercise there in his yard, the broom, the hose, the bucket of suds, the sun, a steady pressure. And as he wiped the tables and squared the furniture, he thought, no wonder Scott and Dan and Alan like this. The pool was clean, a diamond blue, and there wasn't a crumb on the deck. Edison wandered around another half hour, and then he put his tools away with great care. That evening, the women did a slow dance around him. He felt it as confused push and pull. He watched the children in the pool, their groupings and regroupings, and then he'd have a new cold beer in his hand, talking again to Scott Plum about chlorine. He sat in the circle of his friends on folding chairs in the reflected swimming pool light, with Paula or Janny right behind him, hip against his shoulder. And he held everyone's attention now, describing with his hands out in the air a game he'd designed to let the children choose who got to ride in the front seat. It's called First Thumb, he said, lifting his thumbs from each fist, one, then the other. Edison named the different children and how they played the game and who had gotten to sit in the front seat today and how. His hands worked like two puppets. The women laughed. The men smiled, and Janny pulled Edison's empty beer bottle out of his hands and replaced it with a full one. You're too much, Dan Hanover said. This is a hell of a summer for you. I'll be glad when you get this spec project done and get over and give us a hand in applications. He leaned forward and made his hands into a ring, fingertip to fingertip. We've got engine housings. Not just the housings. The whole acceptor, Alan Reed interrupted. And the radial displacement and timing has a huge window. Anything we want. We've got carte blanche, Ed. Funding. You'd be good on this team, Dan Hanover said. Solve, Alan Reed said, tapping Edison's beer bottle with his own. For X. Wrapped in a towel like a little chieftain, Toby waddled up and leaned between his father's legs for a moment, his wet hair sweet on Edison's face. Then he called his sister's name suddenly and ran back into play. Right. Edison did not know what to say. He picked up Toby's wet towel in both hands and looked at the men. Later, as the party was breaking up and the friends clustered at the gate, Dan Hanover said, "It's a relief to have you joining the real world." And Alan Reed clamped his arm around Edison and said, "It's been a good run. You're a hell of a guy." Melissa Reed took his upper arm against her new bosom and said, "Don't listen to him, Edison. He says that because you remind him of what he was like 10 years ago." She squeezed Edison's arm and kissed him on the lips. But his face had fallen. That night, after everyone left, Edison was agitated and distracted while they cleaned up. He shadowed Leslie around the deck and through the house, and at some point he dumped a load of towels in the laundry room and continued on into his study. After Leslie had cleared the patio, blown out all the candle lanterns, and squared the kitchen away, she found Edison at his desk. She stood in the doorway for a minute, but he was wrapped on his calculations. He was there through the night, working, as he was in the morning and all the long afternoon. He accepted a tuna sandwich about midday. She found him asleep at 5 p.m., his face on the large sheet of paper surrounded by his animated figurings and the nubs of 6 pencils. She helped him into bed, where he woke at midnight with a tiny start that opened Leslie's eyes. "Greetings," she said. His voice was rocky and uneven. "I went back in. I walked all the way over the low hills, and I climbed up and back over and into the woods. I found the same woods, and I gathered most of the little people. They're like children, I mean. Sometimes they follow, and so now I think I'm headed in the right way." He sighed heavily, and she could hear the fatigue in his chest. "Get some sleep." He was whispering, "I don't have them all, and I see now that's part of it. I'm not sure you ever get them all. There are mountains beyond these I didn't even know about." Leslie lay still. He knew she was awake. "But that's another time. Now I can keep these guys together and come down. Do you see? I can wrap this up." She was silent, so he added, "There weren't any bears." "Stop," she said quietly. "You don't want that game." "It took all night, but I was able to find them because I knew you were waiting." Leslie could hear the ghost of the old exhilaration in his voice. "Edison," she said, taking his hand, "I'm not there. You need to understand that I'm not at the Silver Bus anymore. I waited. I saw you give up. Why would I wait? Where'd you go?" There were seconds between all the sentences. "Where are you?" She spoke slowly. "I don't know. It's way north. I'm in town. Living in a small town. Above the hardware store in an apartment." He rose to an elbow and she could feel him above her as he spoke. "What's it like there? How far is it?" "I just got here. No one knows me. It's getting colder. I wear a coat when I walk to the library in the afternoons. I've got to get the kids in school." Edison lay back down and she heard the breath go out of him. "In town," he said. "Are the leaves turning?" "Listen." Now she rolled and covered him, a knee over, her arm across his chest. "My landlord asked about you."
"Who?
He asked about me?"
"Where my husband was."
Leslie put her hand on his shoulder and pulled herself up to kiss him. Held it.
"How long I'd be in town."
"And you told him I was lost?"
"He likes you?"
"He's a nice man." Leslie shifted up again and now spoke, looking down into his eyes.
He said no one could survive in those hills. Winter comes early. He admired you, your effort. She kissed him. But you weren't the first person lost to the snow. He's been to your place? Edison's arms were up around her now, and she moved in concert with him. He's the landlord. She kissed him deeply, and her hands were moving. He likes my coffee.
I always liked your coffee.
Edison shifted and pulled her nightshirt over her head, her sudden skin quickening the dark.
Edison, Leslie whispered, you're not a hell of a guy. You're not like any of them. Don't join the team.
She had been still while she spoke, and now she ran her hand up, finally stopping with her first finger on his nose.
Don't solve for X. Just get all your little people to the bus and drive to town.
She pressed her forehead against his.
I left the keys. I know where they are, he said.
His hand was at her face now, too, and then along her hip. The signal. And he turned them, rolled, so that he looked down into her familiar eyes.
Were you scared, she said? What was it like when it started to snow and you were still lost? Everything went white. I wanted to see you again.
Every word was sounded against her skin, her hair.
It didn't seem particularly cold, but the snowflakes, when they started, there were trillions.
That was James Norton reading Ron Carlson's Towel Season. We had a little time left over, so our producer, Sarah Montague, spoke to Carlson from his home near the Pacific about this wonderful story and his work as a writer.
Your stories always seem to me to be as American as apple pie on the surface, but then under the surface they're really subtle and complex. Is that kind of how you think people, how Americans live their lives?
I think it's probably the way people live their lives. I mean, there's everything we can see, the way people conduct themselves and interact, and all the great inventories in American life. But underneath, I mean, there's all this desire and hope, I think, the hope that we might connect, kind of a constant fear of disappointment, all of these other agendas running, myriad agendas running underneath. As a writer, when you tell a story, there's always two stories. You start out knowing one, mm-hmm. and that's the adventure in a short story, is staying with the one story that you sort of know. The many times it's the exterior story, and staying with it long enough that an interior will be discovered.
In fact, I came across an older interview with you in which you said something about, and then the story turned on me, as stories sometimes do. Is that what you were referring to?
Yes. There's this, at this point, it's wonderful, but it's sort of terrible moment, terrifying, where you're out in a story and you're enjoying it, very much like walking into the ocean, and then there comes a moment when you can't touch the bottom. And that's the moment you want.
Three of the stories of yours that we've featured on Selected Shorts, On the USS Fortitude, The H Street Sledding Record, one of my all-time favorites, and as Isaiah Sheffer said in his introduction to this program, one of our listeners' all-time favorites, and the story that's on this program, Towel Season, all seem to be about hope in various forms. Can you comment on that?
Well, it was native to me, a hope. That is, I think it's native to a lot of people. I've had a sort of fortunate life, that is to say it was ordinary, and I grew up in the West, and there were lots of stories in our house. I mean, I had a lot of reasons, given the empirical evidence, to be sort of an optimist. And I think hope is a real force, and I don't mean it in a saccharine sense. I think hope is as powerful and real, almost a fearsome force, as any of the other desires or agendas human beings have. I only know I work from the evidence that I've been given, that an idea will come or an event that I'll try to open up and understand what it is by writing the story. And many times the people land on or near their feet.
What a nice image that is. With that in mind, can you talk a little bit in more detail about towel season, which has a particularly remarkable construct, I think?
Well, towel season is really fun to talk about because it's a mystery to me, too. I started with this character who was sort of like me in that he was trying to investigate things he didn't know. And so they were so far from being able to be literally understood that he speaks about them in metaphors. And he had a sort of suburban life. And as I wrote this story, I simply let the life of his family and his friends open up and unfold as I counter that to his own investigations in mathematics. I think the story started, the ignition moment, was one time when I did trip over a pile of towels. I sort of lay there filled with relief that I hadn't been hurt and curiosity. And then I thought, this is what it is to be in a household, to be thinking about something else and walk by a pile of towels and get entangled. So I started with that, very surface, very literal. And then as the story deepened on me and I began to see the players, I understood what he was up to, sort of. But then I saw his wife, this partner, his life partner, ascend into her own understanding. And two people can play that game. And so the ending of that story, as they begin their last discussion together, they're still... makes me smile because it was a discovery. I came to it and all of a sudden she jumped in and the metaphor started to bloom in a way that I hadn't seen it was going to. And so it happens many times in stories that when you start to be surprised, that's when you have to bring all of your attention and go very, very slowly. And it's just a pleasure.
I think one of the real pleasures of the story, in fact, is that sense that she's able to join in and help him, even though this is not her language, that they wind up learning how to share not something as quotidian as the towels, but a metaphor, that they can work together on a metaphor, is a really lovely picture of a marriage.
Well, I think that one of the things I've tried to do in my work, and as I've dealt with people and as I've written characters, is look all around the circle and look at every character very carefully and make sure that she or he is getting his due. And has the writer honored the character by making the character capable of the moment? And when I saw her at the edges of the story, I thought, oh, she's coming in. Okay, she's going to be in her ascendancy here. And in fact, with her understanding of what's going on, that really reveals and is the key to the story.
I found an interview that you did years ago with a teen magazine.
Oh.
In which you said that your life motto would be, make haste to be kind. Would you still say that, do you think?
Oh, more than ever. Absolutely more. There isn't any time to waste. If you have to cross the street to do it, do it.
I think you bring it to bear in your fiction, too. I mean, people seem
Thank
to try
you.
To get better in there somehow.
Thank you very much. That's terrific.
The author, Ron Carlson. We'll be back after a break with a humorous story read by B.D. Wong. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. Here's a fine short short by Ha Jin, who served in the Army of the People's Republic of China for 6 years and came to America in 1985. It's called A Bad Joke, and the reader is the Broadway and television star B.D. Wong.
At last, the two jokers were captured. Police were after them, so they had come to town without any suspicion. The instant they entered Everyday Hardware, a group of policemen sprang at them, pinned them to the cement floor, and handcuffed them from behind. With stupefied faces smeared by sawdust, they screamed, "You made a mistake, comrade policeman! We didn't steal anything! Shut up!" The police plugged their mouths with washcloths from a bucket and then hauled them out to the white van waiting on the street. At the police station, the interrogation started immediately. It didn't go well, though, because the two peasants denied that they had spread any counter-revolutionary slander. The police chief, a bespectacled, pockmarked man, reminded them of the joke they had told. To everyone's astonishment, the tall peasant asked the chief, "Who's Deng Xiaoping? I never met him." He turned to his buddy, "Have you?" "Uh-uh. I guess he must be a general or a big official," said the short peasant. "Stop pretending," the chief shouted. "Comrade Deng Xiaoping is the chairman of our party and our country." "Really?" the tall peasant asked. "You mean he's number one now?" "Yes. How about Chairman Mao? We only know Chairman Mao. He passed away 6 years ago." "You didn't know?" "That's so?" the short peasant cried. "I didn't know he's dead. He's the emperor to us. No, more like a granddad. His portrait still hangs in my home." The police officers tried hard to keep from laughing. Their chief looked thoughtful. Before the interrogation, he had thought he could easily handle this pair of yokels. Now it was obvious they were smart fellows playing the fool to dodge the charge. He'd better dismiss them for today. It was already late afternoon, so that he could figure out a way to make them admit their crime. He ordered the guards to take the two away and put them into their cell. 7 weeks ago, the two peasants had gone to Sunlight Department Store on Peace Avenue. "Can we take a look at the rubber loafers?" the tall peasant asked at the counter, drumming his thick fingers on the glass top. Three sales girls were sitting on a broad window ledge, silhouetted against the traffic lights on the street. They stopped chatting, and one of them got up and came over.
"What size?"
she asked.
42,
said the tall man. She handed him a pair. Pointing at the price tag, she said,
$5.50.
"What?" the short peasant exclaimed. "Last month it was 5 yuan a pair. How come it's 5.50 now? 10% inflation in a month? Crazy!"
$5.50,
said the girl, annoyed. She twitched her nose, which had the shape of a large garlic clove.
"Too expensive for this old man," said the tall peasant, who was in his mid-30s.
He dropped the shoes on the counter with a thump. As the two men walked away, the tall man spat on the floor and said loudly to his buddy,
"Damn! All prices go up, only our chairman never grows."
The short man grinned and added,
"Yeah, that dwarf won't change."
Hearing their words, the sales girls all tittered. The peasants turned around and took off their blue caps, waving and smiling at the girls, their swarthy faces marked with big parentheses. Within an hour, a joke was circulating in the department store. "All prices go up, but Deng Xiaoping never grows." Within a day, thousands of people in our city had heard the joke. Like a spook, it soon began haunting offices, factories, restaurants, theaters, bathhouses, alleys, neighborhoods, train stations. The two peasants slept well in the cell, happy for the free dinner of sorghum porridge and stewed pumpkin. But they still had no inkling of what crime they had committed.
At 9 o'clock a.m., the three sales girls arrived at the police station. One of them was ordered to repeat what she had heard the Joker say. She pointed at the tall man's concave face and testified, "He said, 'All prices have gone up, but Deng Xiaoping never grows.'" "God damn it!" the man shouted and slapped his knee, his slanty eyes flashing. "I never heard of him! How could I ever come up with that weird name?" The short man cut in, "We never mention him. We said our chairman will never change." "What did you say exactly?" asked the bald policeman in charge of the team of detectives. The tall peasant replied, "All prices go up and only our chairman never grows. I meant our chairman Lu of our commune." The short peasant added, "Dwarf Lu is an awful man. We all hate him. He wouldn't let us have more than 1.5 yuan for a work day because he wants to use the money to build a reservoir for catfish and big-headed carp. What can little shrimps like us get from a reservoir? Not even fish dropping. Everybody knows all the fish will end up in the official stomachs. If you don't believe me, you go check and see if Chairman Lu's a dwarf." He gave a broad grin, displaying his carious teeth. A few men and women chuckled, but they turned silent at the sight of the interrogators' somber faces. The chief asked the sales girls to recall the original words of the joke. To his bewilderment, they remembered that the tall peasant had indeed said, "Our chairman never grows." In fact, when they had relayed the words to others, they hadn't mentioned Deng Xiaoping either. Somehow, in the process of dissemination, the joke had changed into its present monstrous form. Could this whole thing have originated from a misinterpretation? Perhaps, and perhaps not. The interrogators were at a loss now. How could they determine when and where the joke had shed its original ambiguity and acquired its definitive meaning? It was unlikely that their superiors would accept misinterpretation as the explanation for what had happened. The crime was already a fait accompli, and how could there be a crime without a criminal? Even though a deliberate misinterpreter might never be identified, someone had to be responsible for the final version of the joke. So, how should they proceed with the interrogation? Again, the chief had the peasants return to their cell. He then sent a jeep to the commune to fetch Chairman Lu. Everybody was impressed by Chairman Lu's handsome looks, a round forehead, ivory teeth, curved brows, large eyes shaded by miniature fans of lashes. What a handsome and intelligent face he had. If he were not 3'2", you could easily have taken him for a movie star. In addition, he had dignified manners, and his voice sounded so elegant that everybody could tell he was a well-educated man. Small wonder that even with a deformed physique, he could govern a large commune. At noon, he met with the police chief and said, "Look, comrade chief, you ought to punish the two hooligans, teaching them an indelible lesson. Else, how can I lead 31,000 people? In the countryside, no leader can afford to be the butt of ridicule." "I can sympathize with that," the chief said. "In fact, last week the provincial governor called our city and asked about this case. Probably Beijing already knows of it too." At 2:10 p.m., the interrogation resumed. A few minutes after they sat down in the room, the two peasants insisted that they were wronged and should be released. They declared they both came from poor families, and they had always loved the party and the socialist motherland, though they had not been active in political studies and were ignorant of current affairs. They promised the chief that they would take great pains to educate themselves and would never make trouble again. The first thing they'd do after their release, they said, was buy a radio so that they could keep up with news. The chief waved his hand to cut them off. "You still refuse responsibility for the slander against Chairman Deng? Then how could I let you go? Your attitude is not right." "Heavens," the short peasant wailed, "this is a misunderstanding. Comrade policeman, please." "That's irrelevant," the chief said. "Look at it this way. Say that a sentence in a book can be read in different ways, and some people get a reactionary meaning out of it. Now, who should be responsible for the reading, the writer or the reader?" Probably the writer, said the tall man. Correct. All the evidence shows you two co-authored the slander, so you have to answer for the consequences. Does that mean you won't let us go home? Asked the short man. Correct. How long are you going to jail us? It depends. A month. Maybe life. What? The tall peasant shouted. I haven't thatched my house for the winter yet. My kids will freeze to death if you keep me in. You still don't get it, Chairman Liu bellowed and slapped the tabletop with his fleshy hand. You both should feel lucky that you're still alive. How many people were executed because they spread counter-revolutionary rumors? Keep your butts in prison here and then remold yourselves into new men. I'll have your families informed of where to send your underclothes, if you have any. In amazement, people all turned to look at the little man standing on an upholstered chair. Unshod, his large feet were in violet woolen socks. The chief ordered the guards, send them to the city prison and put them among the political criminals. He took off his glasses, smirking and wiping the lens on the sleeve of his shirt. True, he couldn't pass a definite sentence on the jokers, because the length of their imprisonment would depend on how long the provincial administration was interested in the case. Chairman Liu, have mercy, please, begged the tall man. Liu said, it serves you right. See if you dare to be so creative again. I do it to your little ancestors, Dwarf Liu, the short peasant yelled, stamping his feet. Four policemen walked up, grabbed the prisoners, and hauled them away.
B.D. Wong read A Bad Joke by Ha Jin. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.